right. First of all, Dr. John B. Alexander, a little bit of background on him educationally. The University of Nebraska at Omaha, BGS in Sociology, 1971, Pepperdine University in 1975, an MA in Education there, Walden University, a PhD in Education in 1980, University of California, Los Angeles School of Engineering and Applied Science Engineering Management Program in 1990, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Sloan School of Management, Executive Program in Management of Complex Organizations in 1991, and Harvard University, John F. Kennedy School of Government, Program for Senior Executives in National and International Security, 1993. Dr. Alexander has been an investigator of and a developer of non-lethal warfare systems. He is an absolutely fascinating person, and I trust that we have him on the line. Dr. Alexander?
Great.
Good. We've got you. You know what I think, Doctor? I think I should allow you to introduce Colonel Corso. Many people will not know who Colonel Corso is. They might know he's got a book called The Day After Roswell, and that might be about all they know. What would you say of Colonel Corso beyond that?
Well, I first met Colonel Corso about a year ago, and he came to us with a very unusual story, and that had to do, of course, with alien technology and the things that he has written about in his book. One of the things that struck us, of course, was his credentials, and of course, sometimes people fake them. So I spent a week in Washington checking out his background.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the Pentagon, the National Archives, the Army Military History. I also went to the Army War College because a key person in all of the things that he talks about is a Lieutenant General Art Trudeau. And Trudeau, in the Army and military at all, was a legend. In fact, he was so well known that when the Army started doing their oral histories, he was one of the first eight people to be interviewed. Now, where this gets important is that during this interview, Phil Corso sat in every session with the general. So here it is, 20 years after they both retired, and they still remained very close friends. And one of the stories is he actually got his boss fired at one time, which is not usually career-enhancing, but survived that and remained to be very close friends. So what I can say is when Phil says he was in the National Security Council, he was in this foreign technology division in the Pentagon. Now, that should not be confused with the thing at Wright-Patterson. This was a small Army thing. Basically, it was Phil, and a position that he held until he retired, looking at foreign materiel. And, of course, he claims that this, some of it at least, was from the crash saucer.
So it would be fair to say the colonel is a former Army intelligence officer.
That's true.
All right.
He worked in with a heavy background in research and development.
Anyway, I've got a little bit more on the colonel, and I'd like to read it. Former intelligence officer, yes. Part of the Allied occupation forces in Rome from 1944 through 47. At the end of World War II, Operation Paperclip, which brought German rocket scientists to the United States. During the Korean War, he served under General MacArthur, and from 1953 through 57 as a member of the National Security Council under President Eisenhower. It was in 1961 that Colonel Corso was appointed chief of the Army's Foreign Technology Division. It was then, on a certain fateful day, as the colonel tells it, that a file cabinet was wheeled into his office, the contents of which he was asked to examine by Trudeau. Corso was advised the contents were not, quote, run-of-the-mill foreign stuff, unquote, and was suggestively told to research the Roswell file before writing up his summary. Among the items in the cabinet The colonel says he found a mysterious shoebox of tangled wires, a dull, grayish, silvery foil-like swatch of cloth that he was unable to fold, bend over, tear, or wad up, but that bounded right back into its original shape without any crease. I wonder if any of you recall from the movie that exact description. Visually, you saw that material in the movie Roswell. And though it was a dramatic reenactment, that was obviously very much like is we have described here. And that is just the beginning. So there are many, many questions. All right, let's see if we can bring him on. Colonel, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we don't yet have Dr. Alexander back, but we definitely have you. And what I'd like you to do, if you'd be willing, is to add to what Dr. Alexander said and tell us about your own background.
My background, I came in the Army in 1940 when the war started, right after Pearl Harbor. And I was drafted, and I went to officer school, and I came out as second lieutenant, and they put me in an artillery outfit. Right after that, I got transferred to intelligence, and I was sent to England, got promoted to first lieutenant, and I joined British MI-19, and they sent me to Cambridge for 3 weeks, and I learned intelligence under them. And from there, I went to North Africa. I became an interrogator, prisoners of war, and worked with the British and with their commandos. Then I went to North Africa. And from North Africa, I participated in the landing at Salerno Harbor in Italy. Then I came up through Italy all the way to Cassino. And I was in the battles of Cassino. And from there, I landed on the beach at Anzio. And then went into Rome. And there, they made me Assistant Chief of Staff, T2 Intelligence, and Intelligence Security Chief of Rome Area Command. And I participated there in reestablishing law and order. I destroyed the Gestapo and SS nets. And from there, I came back to Fort Riley, Kansas.
So your career, to the point that you met the general, was a very honorable and fairly normal military career.
It was in combat at the time. We were fighting a war in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. And then I joined the general. I went to Korea after that. I participated in the Korean War, and I joined MacArthur's staff over there. And I came back. And when I came back to the States, I joined President Eisenhower as one of his military aides in National Security Council at the White House. And there my career sort of changed. I was in the White House for 4 years. And from there I took command of a missile battalion, the Army's missile firing range at White Sands.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took a combat missile battalion, and I had atomic warheads even, to Germany. And I stayed in command 18 months, and then I became Inspector General of 7th Army. And from there I came back to the United States. And General Trudeau had reorganized research and development of the Army. And he sent for me, and I joined him as a special assistant and chief of the Foreign Technology Division.
So you had a very, very long military career before you met General Trudeau.
Yeah. Well, I met him when he was chief of Army Intelligence, and he sent me to the White House.
Okay, but at all this prior military service, Colonel,
yes.
You never laid hands on any sort of extraterrestrial anything had a hint of it. Everything you did was
No, I didn't. Not until I got to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Was very terrestrial and very normal and very heroic, I'm
very head. Normal, yes, it was.
And that's where, I guess, with General Trudeau, in what year?
I joined him. First, I was in Army Intelligence, and he sent me to the White House. So I stayed there for 4 years. And then I came back to the United States in 1960, and I immediately joined him in research and development.
What did you do at the White House, Colonel?
I was on the policy. The Operations Coordinating Board was the policy guidance system. It investigated policy and made policy. And we were known as checked up on policy. And I actually chaired a lot of policy groups.
And President Eisenhower, he, for example, assigned me a case was called the Volunteer Freedom Corps, where we're going to set up units in Germany, Polish and Czech and Romanians, flying a uniform with the uniform of their nation, and we were going to arm them. And he wanted to put this, and I worked on that and put in, and we already put it in effect, and then he had his heart attack, and it went sort of downhill. CIA opposed it, and State Department opposed it. And I found out later that they used deceptive methods to oppose it.
All right. Dr. Alexander, you went to Washington and basically confirmed all of this background?
Yes, and probably a bit more. As I said, this is high-level intrigue, but it turns out that it's really true, and that is that General Trudeau, as the Chief of Staff Intelligence, Army Chief of Staff Intelligence, another, the highest intelligence guy in the Army, was fired. And
why? Or maybe I ought to say, for what?
there's high-level intrigue going on, and supposedly he had passed information to Adenauer, which the Dulles boys, who had CIA and state, were quite unhappy with.
Now, and, I was involved in that, and I can fill in the background if I guess John wants to do it.
Well, go ahead. You've got a better feel than I, Phil.
Yeah, okay. Well, what happened is I brought General Trudeau what we called the National Intelligence Estimates. These were the basis for U.S. policy, and they were made by CIA.
And, Colonel, the comment was made that you got your boss fired.
Well, possibly I caused it. I was a trained intelligence officer by the British, and, so, and we had at the White House what we called National Intelligence Estimates. All were top secret. They were basis for U.S. policy. CIA made them up, and they were supposed to be compiled from hard intelligence.
This, Colonel, is the kind of thing that today you would see somebody walk in and put on the president's desk in the morning. That sort of report?
Well, it was sort of. But this was a basis for policy, and later would become national policy.
I might add, Art, these are very comprehensive reports. These are based on long-term projections. A number of people look at them, and they are the intelligence community gets together and say, this is our best estimate.
So are these, in effect, not daily intelligence reports?
No, they're not daily.
But
they
summations that lead to a firm policy change for our government?
Most of the estimates that I uncovered were vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and Communist bloc. And I found out, since I could check intelligence from the military sources, I found out that they were not based on intelligence. It was mostly ideology, and just 2 years ago, CIA admitted this in newspaper articles. For example, I went to the general one day on the loss of Formosa, and I told him there was a national intelligence estimate on that. It was not important, so the general called CIA, called Alan Dulles, and he told him no such estimate existed. And I pulled the copy of it out of my briefcase and handed it to him. And I won't repeat what the general said. Now, these estimates, I found out that they were not based on hard intelligence. They were based on their thinking and ideology. And this was dangerous because most of them were apologetic to the Soviet Union. And we considered that a great danger. So when I laid these out to the general, and by the way, in 1962, I testified for 2 days in front of a committee of Congress, a Senate Judiciary Committee, and this testimony is still rated top secret. It was on this subject. And Trudeau refused to comment on these overnight like they wanted, because they didn't want anybody to check on them. So they made up an excuse that he gave when Adenauer called him in Washington, and he briefed Adenauer on these cards. Well, I get in the act, and I send over to Germany, the CIC, the military, and I told them, get me information that Galen's outfit is penetrated. And they did. So Alan Dulles immediately took off for Turkey. And I still remember that's where he went. And two of my friends, former ambassador of Thailand, Max Bishop, and ambassador to South America, Mexico, Robert Hill, came with me. We went to see Senator Bridges at the time chairman of the Armed Services Committee. Mm-hmm. And he was a tough old man. And he promised us that there wouldn't be another officer promoted in the Army until Trudeau was brought back and promoted. And he did. He got promoted to Lieutenant General. So this was the intrigue that went on. And, of course, this increased my animosity with CIA because they didn't like an intelligence officer uncovering this.
I'm
sure. And remember, at the time, I was at the White House, which was considered above them. So I could call a few names back when I wanted to. And there was not much they could do about it. But this was the intrigue that where General Trudeau was relieved and then brought back bigger than ever. In fact, he took command of a corps and came back and reorganized research and development, which was in logistics, a secondary mission.
All right. Who was responsible, do you think, for bringing General Trudeau back?
Yes, because we were close. Until the old gentleman died, we were close friends.
No, I understand that, but what I'm asking, Colonel, is who
Strong
was...
Strom Thurmond. What was that? Who brought him back?
Yeah, who brought back General Trudeau?
Well, Secretary of the Army Brooker and a couple of generals, the Chief of Staff, who was at the time, I forget his name, but he was a friend of the generals, and they brought him back, and he became Chief of Research and Development.
But it was because of Strom Thurmond and the support from the Hill.
Yes.
So Congress is integrally involved in this.
That's right, they were.
Right.
There were strong senators, Senator Eastland, Senator Dirksen, Senator McClellan, and Senator Thurmond and Nolan, and people like that were involved on General Trudeau's side. And I know because I talked to everyone on personally.
And so they wanted him then as chief of R&D, and I take it despite all the political intrigue earlier, they knew him to be a patriot, they knew him to be a good man, and they trusted him, and I presume that's why they brought him back.
This was a general that took his helmet off with two stars. He was a division commander at Pork Chop Hill, and went up and fought with his men. He put on a sergeant's helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a major general, division commander. That's the type of man he was. And also very religious. He went to retreats at Loyola, and one of the most brilliant men I ever knew in my life.
And so naturally, as he came back, so did you with him.
Well, I came back from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And when he found out I was back, he sent for me. And I walked in his office, and I saluted him, and he said, "You aboard, Phil?" I told him, "Yes, sir." He said, and the only order he ever gave me was, "Phil, watch things for me. The rest don't understand." And what he meant, the inside workings of the government.
Hmm.
So that was a story on the general.
Okay.
Because he challenged the estimates, which were a danger to us. Because the Soviet Union at the time had said, we will bury you.
I recall.
Yeah.
So.
By the way, a defector told me that he was talking to Brezhnev in Germany and in Russia. There's a defector from Poland named Golonesky. And I asked him if he ever heard of Trudeau. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Brezhnev told me," and Brezhnev was premier then, he said that this is the most dangerous general in the U.S. Army. A defector actually told me that. Michael Golonesky.
And from what point of view do you think he meant that, the most dangerous man?
He meant that also as a fighting general and because of his knowledge also in R&D and intelligence. He knew what they were up to.
All right, this is obviously going to get fairly complicated, and with all our phone troubles, we've made our way to the bottom of the hour. So everybody just relax for a few moments. Respectively, Dr. John Alexander in Las Vegas and Colonel Philip Corso. Gentlemen, you're both back on the air again. All right, so now you went to work for General Trudeau, and this is where things begin to get interesting for you.
Yes.
At this point, again, you had never laid hands on anything extraterrestrial, probably hadn't seen a UFO or anything else. In other words, you were not any sort of ufologist or even interested.
No, I saw a body at Fort Riley, Kansas, but I put that out of my mind until I could corroborate information, like in intelligence, and prove it. And later there were some experiences that happened. My radars were picking up objects at White Sands when I commanded the range battalion, traveled 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour.
I guess that we'd better back up then. If you saw a body at Fort Riley, Texas... Tell my audience...
It was in Kansas.
Tell my audience that story.
Well, what it was, I was appointed one night post-duty officer. Actually, lately there have been some criticisms They said that the security was lax at Fort Riley if I did that. But I was the security officer that night, or the post-duty officer. And people know the Army know that when you're appointed post-duty officer, you're responsible for all the guards and security all that night and the post.
Why would anybody criticize that? I was in the Air Force, Colonel, and I remember that most all bases had an on-duty officer for the nighttime.
Well, the critics didn't know this. They weren't in the Army. And really, that night, I was a security. And when I went down, one of my sergeants, Messer Sergeant I knew well, was Sergeant of the Guard in the because we had horses in the area, the veterinarian area. And these five, I think it was five of them, yes. There was five boxes there that looked like caskets. And I went on in the room, because I was a security officer, I had to go inspect it. They told me it was sensitive cargo there. It come by truck.
Was it in transit, or was
it
that...
It was in transit.
It was in transit, all right.
I'll tell you how I knew that. Now, I went in and I picked up the tarp, and I saw this body. Of course, I turned a little bit. At first, I thought it was a young, you know, baby or something. Then I got a little bit turned, like you do in combat, you know, when something like that happens, your stomach gets upset, but you recover fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the sergeant, get out of here, because since it's a delay, I don't want you in trouble. Go out to your post, and I'll be out in a second. I put the tarp back down, tarp. Now, this only lasted 10 or 15 seconds.
And what do you recall seeing? You say you saw a body, Colonel.
I saw an extraterrestrial, skinny arms, skinny legs, under 5 feet, had a fairly large head, not large, but compared to the body, it was large, and the eyes, they were slanted eyes, no nose, no mouth, no ears. And it was floating in some liquid, and it was a gray color. And that's what I saw. And I immediately dismissed it. I figured, I don't know what it is until I can corroborate like an intelligence, maybe in the later. And later on, I was able to prove what it was.
Do you know what that liquid was?
No, I had no idea.
Uh-huh. And you say there were a total of five. Is that correct? Five caskets or five, if that's what you want to call
them? No, they were crates-like. But
crates.
They had a liquid in them. The thing was floating in some sort of liquid.
Okay, what date was this, as best you can recall?
It was Fort Riley, Kansas.
And the date?
1947.
How?
It was in July.
July.
Because I went to Fort Riley, Kansas. I was stationed out there with garrison duty. We had an intelligence aggressor force we were setting up for the military, and we were writing courses for intelligence. And I joined the Department of Non-Resident Instruction at Fort Riley, Kansas.
All right. Since you're an eyewitness to this, and you're now 82 years old, is that correct?
82.
It's very, very important that we be very clear about what you saw there. This is a very key point, I believe. The Air Force, as you well know, had a news conference and said, well, they were dummies. Now, is there any chance that what you saw, and in fact, as you know, the Air Force at their news conference showed these dummies that they dropped in later years, 1953, actually. But even if they had dropped them in 1947, they might have. Could you have been looking at a dummy, a non-being?
You know, I told people in late interviews that I will not criticize the Sister Service. And I won't, because I fought in Korea with them, and I have a lot of friends in the Air Force. But their superiors I will criticize. There was no question in my mind what it was. I know the difference between a body like that I saw there and a dummy. Or even a monkey, like some said. And then they've even come forth and said maybe it was Japanese in that balloon. I don't know where they get these stories or why they make them up. It's beyond comprehension to me. They don't have to do this.
So you saw a creature. There's no question about it.
Yes.
I take it, Colonel, you saw the Air Force's news conference, correct?
Yes.
And you saw the dummies that they showed that were dropped, correct?
Impossibility.
And that is not what was in that...
No chance.
No chance. All right. Do you know where these bodies were next headed?
I do know. I asked, when I came out, I asked the sergeants on the guard that night.
Right.
I asked, and they said, we talked to the drivers. It came from an air base in New Mexico. There were five trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were heading for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The boys, they had a driver and a co-driver. Each truck, and the soldiers told the sergeants that, And they reported that back to me. It was on its way. And remember, in those days, about one of the only cross-country roads was Route 40. And
right.
They were coming through Route 40.
Right.
And they were heading for the Air Force Base in Ohio, Wright-Patterson. And the soldiers told them that. That's where they were going.
All right. Do you think that anybody else, the soldiers accompanying these caskets or whatever they were, also saw these beings?
Well, the sergeant did that I was with, that came in with me, and then I told him to get out because it was sensitive.
Where is that sergeant?
I can't answer that.
Okay, where is that sergeant now, do you know?
It's been 50 years, Art. I don't know. I wish I did know, because
okay.
He was a good boy, you know.
Well, he may be
a master sergeant.
A master sergeant at that time.
Yes.
So he may or may not still be with us.
That, Art, I can't answer. I don't know.
All right. So there you... saw it, you saw this body, and then what?
Then I sort of forgot about it. And then when I became the missile commander at the range in New Mexico, I start picking up these objects traveling 3,000 and 4,000 miles an hour. And I start checking that, and our headquarters didn't want to be informed, so I didn't say much.
They didn't want to be informed?
No. I send one forward. See, on the Nike system, I had tapes. They look like a lie detector thing. And that gave the entire firing sequence. So when one of these events happened, I would call the battery and said, send me the tapes. And this showed if it was true or not. And they actually were accurate. And later I discussed this with the radar people. And then when I went to Germany, I was picking up, every once in a while I'd pick up an object over there going 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour.
And nobody wanted to hear about it?
No, our headquarters, when I sent them the first report, they said, we're not interested, forget it. So I promptly forgot it, and I didn't report it any longer.
Dr. Alexander, does that make sense to you, or for that matter, Colonel, does it make sense to you? Then, certainly, we had not made any statement saying UFOs are no threat to national security, we're not interested. It would seem to me anything flying at 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour would have been of intense interest to the military then, or for that matter, now.
Not necessarily. And when you look at things like NORAD and places like that, if you don't believe that there is a threat that can go that fast, and you then say, and you're looking for threat or no threat,
right?
And if it doesn't exist, even if it goes that fast, it's not threatening you, it's no threat. And we were looking for every reason to discard targets, not to try and include them. Remember, computers were not like they are today. I mean, you've got more power on your desktop today than NORAD had in those days.
That is true. And I suppose...
computers were the cam type. We had a needle that revolved around the cam. Then I got... those came from England. Then in my tour, before my tour was up, I had radars, and they were oil data pots. And that was quite an advancement in those days.
And it was, of course, a primitive throw out a bunch of RF and get a return type radar. There was no transponder usage or anything like that. So you were constantly looking at what really was in the air.
Yes. My radars, even in Germany, I had two batteries always on alert. And we were tracking these things. I had an acquisition radar. And then I had two target track radars. There was a pencil beam, which would lock on the aircraft and lock on the missile. One on the aircraft and one on the missile.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer would bring them together. Now, when you fire Nikes, the missiles we had, we'd lock on the target, and then the missile, when it's fired, goes straight up in the air and then dives on the target. And it does not fire slant range. This was the Nike system that we had, which was the best that we had at the time.
All right. Dr. Alexander, as you went back to Washington, again, you confirmed the colonel's service in these areas as best you could.
That is correct. No, he absolutely was the places that he said he was and when he was there and did what he says he did. By the way, Art, one other thing I think ought to be made that I think is important about Phil Corso is this is not the first time that he has come forward and told some pretty remarkable tales. in fact, in 19, I believe it was 92 or 93, talked about a secret war that had been going on. And this was done, reported in 2020, U.S. News and World Report, and to the U.S. Congress. And it was a war that had been going on, and Phil can tell you more about it because it's an important piece of why we responded the way we did. And except for those who had very special clearances, never knew that this was going on.
What secret war are we talking about, Doctor?
We were, for many, many years, we were probing the Soviet air defense. And we would send planes in and try to get them to turn on their electronics so that we could map their air defense system.
Sure.
It was a cat and mouse game, and every once in a while the cat won. And we were losing air crews, and we knew, and Phil can tell you a lot about this, we had people down on the ground, captured, alive, and we didn't even ask for them back.
Sure. What year was that, John?
Oh, this went on for decades.
But with regard to the colonel's involvement?
Well, he was in the White House in the 50s when we had lost some of them.
Also, we had a 100-inch camera, which was highly classified at the time. From northeast part of Korea, it could photograph alpha stock.
Really?
And this was highly classified at the time. And we were flying that over there. Now, Chris Wallace on primetime, he asked me one day when I was being interviewed on TV, Cold War, and I told him, Chris, I don't want to be ludicrous or it's not a joke. I'm very dead serious on this. I don't know of any Cold War. Every war I've been involved in was a hot war.
Mm.
And I told him, and people, boys were dying, they were shooting at each other, 30-millimeter shells and everything else coming at them.
Colonel, how many aircraft and air crew are you aware of that we lost during those kinds of operations?
I don't have the number, Art, but this went on for quite a few years. And it was a constant battle. And we lost a lot of men. In fact, I had a situation where when I testified in missing prisoners of war, a woman came out to me with her daughter. And they gave me the name of Lieutenant Colonel. I said, oh, yes, I remember him. He's a technical advisor on one of these airplanes with a 100-inch camera. And I used to receive the reports or the photos. The little girl got over and kissed me on the cheek. She said, finally, we don't know what our father did when he got killed, because the Pentagon told us he was joyriding. I told him he was not joyriding. He was a technical observer. Now, these things happened, you know. And Chris Wallace, and we walked in front of the White House. He took some photographs. He had his cameraman there. And he stopped and he said, Colonel, I understand. After all, you people are responsible for security of the nation. I told him, Chris, I'm glad to hear that you understand what we were doing.
Well, I understand that it had to be done. It is a little difficult for the American people to understand that when these air crews went down, even if they lived, they were basically abandoned.
Yes, they were. I testified in front of the House Committee and the Senate Committee on this problem.
What do you think happened to those men, Colonel?
I told President Eisenhower what happened to the, for example, at Panmunjom John. I was on a truce delegation, and I was on the ground when the boys were being exchanged. A Korean colonel we had told him, civilians told him, there was 500 sick and wounded 10 miles from Panmunjom. I wrote this up. Well, then our prisoners came through, and those boys told me that they saw those boys there. They were sick and wounded, pretty badly sick and pretty badly wounded. So I wrote up a presentation, and the chief delegate took it up at Panmunjom. The Chinese general broke a pencil in half when he heard this. Now, none of those boys came back, and they were all dead. They all died. And this was 10 miles, yet I told the Senate Committee for this, you know, they didn't ask me one question about it.
Well, maybe they didn't want to know.
Well, I think the answer to your question is that, particularly for the technical people, that after they fulfilled their usefulness, they were terminated.
Terminated. In other words, no doubt the ones that ended up in enemy hands were tortured for whatever information could be gleaned and then disposed of.
Right.
Well, they also took their identities. That was an intelligence aspect of what I discussed with President Eisenhower.
I wonder how people who have knowledge of this, Colonel, sleep at night. I mean, do you just rationalize it's war?
Well,
cold or hot, whatever you want to call it, it's war and there are casualties.
And after all, they threatened to bury us, and they were a threat to us, and we had no choice, just like the extraterrestrials. In the military, you think you always, just in case, it's hostile, you're not going to be caught short.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing in extraterrestrials.
All right.
Just in case, we're going to be ready.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about that. You saw a body in 1947. There's no question about what you saw. You know what you saw.
Yes.
It then went on to Wright Field in Patterson. And that really was the last contact of that sort you had until when?
Well, there was these planes were flying at Red Canyon there, and some things happened there. But then what confirmed it really in my mind, the corroboration, which is no question, we financed a laboratory at Walter Reed. Research and Development did.
Yes, sir.
They had autopsy reports. They had one, and they did autopsy reports, which I had in my file.
You had autopsy reports in your file?
Oh, yes. In fact, some of that's mentioned in the book. And I described the extraterrestrial. Actually, the way I described him in the book, that one of the reasons when we tried to make flying saucers and they all didn't work, was the extraterrestrial himself, or it, whatever it was, they had no sex organs.
Uh-huh.
He was a clone and built specifically by some intelligence for space travel. He was actually a part of the flying saucer. He was the guide system.
So technically he was part of the craft.
Yes, he was part of the craft.
Uh-huh.
And he was the guidance system.
Colonel, if I may, how did they make that determination? In other words, all they had, or maybe I'm wrong, was dead bodies. Did they have any live...
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of.
But we know with electromagnetism, and remember, I had some von scientists on my team. I discussed this with Hermann Oberth at Peramundo. He was von Braun's boss, and he believed in space travel and dimensional travel even. And I discussed this with von Braun and my own German scientist. I had two on my team to investigate the line of atoms and metals.
Now back to Dr. John Alexander and Colonel Philip Corso in Las Vegas. Let's back up a little bit. You said you saw actual autopsy reports. How many details do you remember from that?
Oh, I remember quite a few.
What can you tell us? What was in those reports?
Number one, they had a third eyelid. And this eyelid was a collector of light, because these creatures could see at night. And we used that as a basis, one of the bases for our night viewing devices, imaging intensifiers, we call them.
In other words, what we now know as night vision goggles.
That's right. They came from that. That's the seed. And the German Ultra, they had some experiments that they were doing on infrared. And the Germans, I had their documents, and I was very fortunate that I had the scientists there who could explain the documents to me.
Okay, here's where we need to back up a little bit. What knowledge did the Germans have, and how did they get it? Now, the crash that I know about was in New Mexico, but you keep referring to German scientists.
There was a crash in Germany, from Olbert's telling me what he's told me, and there was also some crashes in Russia. And Wilbur Smith, the Canadian genius on electromagnetism, brought us a piece of metal that he got from a downed flying saucer in Canada.
All right. As I recall the last interview we had with you, when you were employed by General Trudeau, one day, or serving under him, I guess I ought to say, one day the general brought to you a filing cabinet.
This was right after he made me head of the Foreign Technology Division.
So it was almost your first job for him.
Well, it wasn't my only job, unfortunately. I had a lot of other duties.
Well, if you were in charge of research and development, John, what kind of work was he doing in R&D?
Well, what he was doing in foreign technology, and one of the things they did was we would recover technology from a number of places. We had called foreign material exploitation. and a lot of it, of course, was Soviet. And we would, you would get a piece of advanced technology, we would bring it in and give it to the laboratories and say, reverse engineer it. How does it work? What are the operating parameters?
Figure out what this is and
right.
how.
So that's a lot of what they were doing.
Like
he's, of course, carrying it to another level.
The helicopter came from France. I mean, the helicopters, the spent uranium that they tried to talk about and said they wanted to outlaw after the Gulf War. Uranium, I got that from the Swiss.
Are you referring to depleted uranium?
Depleted uranium
shells. Yes,
I got that from the Swiss.
From the Swiss.
And then the South Americans had one of the best anti-aircraft units at the time. Then we got a 20 millimeter from the Germans. So we were taking foreign technology where it appeared in the world, and also the foreign technology also uncovered other worlds.
All right, that's
I remember the book is Project Horizon, very important. We were going to put a military colony on the moon in the early 60s.
We were going to put a military... In other words, there were plans
that's
to
Project
do that.
Horizon.
Uh-huh.
There's
50
pages are in the book, but the project itself was 310 pages. In fact, I had a hand in declassifying it.
John, Dr. Alexander, John, have you looked into this aspect of... the Colonel's story that we had a whole plan to put a base on the moon?
Oh, that absolutely exists. He's given me a copy. And one of the things that's not very well known is that, you referred to the Germans before. Remember, that was Operation Paperclip, where at the end of the war we had selected a number of scientists, Wernher von Braun and Oberst and others, and brought them in. And they were working for the Army. And so the Army had developed this plan, and then when NASA was formed, the plans went over to NASA. So basically the plans on, and they were very detailed, on how to get from here to there, and not just travel, but actually to establish bases and fight in space, was being thought about in the 50s.
All right, so this was sort of an ongoing, we've got to get there before they do kind of plan.
Well, we made the plan and wrote it up like it was aimed at the Russians. But if the plan is read and General Trudeau's instructions, they're in the book, but the letters he gave of instruction, you see that we were aiming at any enemy from outer space also. And MacArthur knew about this.
So obviously at that point they had hard knowledge that there were others, and that they were not necessarily friendly at all.
Yes, and what we said, just in case, was our motto.
Just in case. Yeah, just in case. All right. John, where would you think it would be appropriate we take the story now?
Wow. Well, we have kind of gone all over. I think what Phil did from his perspective for research and development. Let me, maybe I'll add another note, if I might. I have had the opportunity to talk to a number of Phil's contemporaries, and the story is very interesting, and I've got to tell you, it's a paradox. I'm talking about people who went on to have ranks at 3- and 4-star general levels, who were colonels at the time.
Right.
And I would ask them, the big question is, where'd this stuff go? And I'd say, do you have it? Can you corroborate it? And they would say, no. And so I said, then we should not believe Phil Corso. And they said, oh, no, he did really strange stuff.
In other words, they're saying, I don't want to admit to any of this. I don't want any part of it. But then you ask about Colonel Corso, and they say, well, yes.
Yeah, they give him very high marks, and these were contemporaries. They were guys who were colonels with him, and as I said, they stayed in and progressed, and at least one of them took General Trudeau's position 2 or 3 moves down, several years later.
All right, let's try developing as we did in the last interview, Colonel, because it is very important. Tell the story about General Trudeau one day delivering to you a file cabinet.
Yes. Well, he gave me the file cabinet, and He said, Phil, there's some things in there. I want you to develop a program for utilization and exploitation of these.
Utilization and exploitation.
With applied engineering, that means go out to industry and people are working on this. You find them, you develop a plan for me.
All right, here you had a file cabinet full of all this stuff. Where did he say it came from?
He didn't tell me. He said, it's in there, Phil. It'll tell you where it came from.
So normally you were working with Soviet stuff or German stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
So I would think that at that moment you probably thought that's exactly what was in the cabinet.
Yeah, well, I had three-drawer cabinet, a master safe. And the top drawer was, I used to, General Trudeau used to kid me and says, that's Corso's junk drawer.
Yeah.
And the UFOs fly in and out of that drawer. And because when I'd lay these artifacts on the table, they look like junk. So he laughed about that and said, "My, of course, it was junk pile."
What was in your junk pile, Colonel?
Well, there was a piece of metal, about a piece of postcard, and the atoms were lined up and aligned in it.
The atoms were aligned.
Aligned. That made it give you terrific strength. Radiation wouldn't pass through. And he gave me the instruction. He told me one day. He said, "Phil, I'm going to appoint a special team, and you're in charge, and the general that John just talked about knows about that team, because he was there at the time. He was a colonel with me. And that team, he told me this. He said, Phil, this is bigger than Los Alamos. Space vehicles, light as a feather, can travel space, no radiation can penetrate it, and nothing can harm them. Because it was paper thin, but the strength was terrific. You couldn't dent it, we couldn't scratch it or anything. Of course, and he told me also, if you find anybody is even coming close to this, fund it. And I had the German scientist work with me on that.
So at that point, you took that and you tried to turn it over to somebody in industry and funded them because you had that power.
Yes, we did. I had the power to fund it.
And basically said, back engineer this or figure out what it is, figure out how to make it?
Well, Livermore Lab up at MIT analyzed it. Force.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, the atoms were lined up in it. I wrote them a letter, and I also wrote Walter Reed a letter. Walter Reed said, started some interesting discussion there, and my co-author has the letter. Then I wrote to Livermore, and I asked them the question whether they could supply any. They said, do you remember the contract, how it read? That we would send all copies back to you and keep nothing here. And they were right.
A technical correction, by the way, that's Lincoln Lab.
Oh, that's
MIT.
Lincoln. You're right, John. I'm glad you caught that. That was Lincoln Lab. Livermore's on California. So they did that, and they remind me that we made them send all copies back to us to keep nothing in their file.
Mm-hmm.
And we funded after all, so they did that. Then I had a... Now, this is an interesting story, Art. I had a piece of looked like string.
String.
The atoms were aligned in it. It was so tough you couldn't burn it, and you couldn't even... cut it.
Was it metallic or was it light string or cord?
Like
thread.
Cloth. It looked like it.
All right.
The nearest thing in this world that we found that was nearest that was a spider web. Terrific strength. You can stretch a spider web for miles. The spider spins it and aligns the atoms in it. And you can stretch it 5-10 miles before it bends and won't break. And then it springs back into space. Now, we funded that with Wyoming University. We made flak jackets out of it, only we couldn't make flak jackets because we couldn't get enough of it. We tried to get them to clone the spider, and I think to this day they haven't succeeded.
Huh.
But there's terrific strength in that, in the spider web. Marvelous thing. Atoms are aligned.
Atoms are aligned. Dr. Alexander, now with two pieces of material from this file cabinet that ultimately, I guess, came from Roswell. Atoms are aligned. Can you explain that?
Not very easily, actually. As I understand what he's talking about is that by instead of having a random selection of the atoms, that they are able to establish the polarity in such a way that the strength was greatly increased.
You're right, John.
But they were actually not able to duplicate the metal. Is that correct?
Well, we failed in that art.
Failed.
We were never able to do it.
All right.
Now, we invented a small atomic engine that's in the Saturn probes and the Mars probes.
Yes.
It was our little iron engine that we built at Fort Belvoir. And we could never harden that, so we couldn't put it in anything that man could travel in it, because we couldn't harden it meant keep the radiation out.
Let me read you this fax I've got, Colonel, and let me ask you about it. We have yet to develop how you got to this technology, but here's somebody reading your book, Colonel, and he says, I'm only halfway through the Colonel's book, but I've reached a very disturbing chapter. The Colonel says that the military has been fighting a war with the aliens since 1947 and considers the aliens to be enemies of the United States. Would you please ask the Colonel if it's true and if indeed these aliens are our enemy?
Art, I had a list of overt acts on their part. Maybe accidental, maybe not planned, but they were overt acts. They killed our men. They brought down aircraft. And they even experimented on civilians. So we had to consider in the military that those were hostile acts. They were hostile.
Colonel, can you give me any details? You say hostile acts, overt acts. They killed our men, you said, and experimented on civilians.
Von Braun even wrote of a missile that was thrown off track by them, by electromagnetism. And we were at Ramstein Air Force Base. They shot at them. And that's in a book also. And the Maelstrom Air Force Base, they flew over that and they knocked out all our guidance system on our Minuteman missiles. The guidance system on every one was knocked out. And then at Bukhanor, at the Cosmodrome in the Soviet Union,
yes, sir.
A UFO came over for 14 seconds and all their steel towers fell apart. All the welds and the rivets came apart. The Cosmodrome was down for about 3 weeks. And the UFO only was over 14 seconds. And also we had information that they followed all our Gemini and all the Russian Voskhod, I think, shot in the air. So we had all that evidence.
Okay. Art?
Yes.
One thing I might add, and this is, I'll be the cautionary note here, is when Phil here talks about the military, and that's a pretty inclusive term, because I don't think that most, if you went to the military, that you would get consensus on this. So this is clearly speaking for some people within the military, as opposed to an institutional position.
Yeah, I think John's right there.
All right. Well, clearly the acts were or appeared to be overt, but from what you have told me, short of people who may have died, it seems hard to conclude that their action was that of an enemy that wanted to come at us or have a war with us, because surely they had the technology to wage a much larger scale war than...
We used to discuss, if they fight a war against us, are they going to fight on our level or their level? Now, that's a question we never quite answered. We didn't think that they were going to fight a war with guns and missiles like we do.
Uh-huh.
They were DNA experts. They made these clones of that superintelligence. And when I analyzed that clone, what a marvelous thing that was. We were remiss on that. We should have diagnosed that thing very minute. That was one of the greatest things they left us, and we were sort of remiss. We didn't do enough.
How much?
That was a marvelous thing.
How much actually did we do? I mean, you said you saw an autopsy report.
Well, we studied the digestive system. There wasn't any.
None.
There was no vocal cords.
No vocal cords.
No ears. They didn't. No sound. We figured that they had four lobes in the brain, and we figured that their communication was mental telepathy.
Would you call them biological entities?
We did. We made that name up. Extraterrestrial biological entities.
You made that name up?
We made that up in the Army. And we called them, we came to the conclusion that they were definitely clones made specifically for space travel. Since man today cannot travel in space. Now, NASA might object to my book because I make that statement. The man is, cannot travel in space, yet these clones were made on that. Of course, somebody's going to come back and say, we spend billions and still man can travel in space. Well, it's a fact. There's nothing I can do about it. It's true. And on Mir, when they come off of Mir, they've been up for 3 months, they have to help them off. The bone marrow and the muscles are affected.
All of that is true.
And the brain is affected, too.
As a matter of fact, there are some very interesting developments with regard to Mir and other space flights in which the crews have begun to get out of control. And I think we are not hearing all about Mir right now. This crew is not in control. They've been basically told, stop what you're doing, just rest, we're going to get you out of there. Back now to my two guests, Dr. John Alexander and retired Colonel Philip Corso. Gentlemen, you're back on the air again. All right, but then some other materials from that filing cabinet, for example, this fiber that you're talking about,
yes,
actually turned out to be what we now know as fiber optics. Is that right?
I had fiber optics was. I had a bunch of. It looked like wires. I really didn't know what it was. And
right.
Light was emitted from. There must have been a power source in it. And then we sent that. I think to Monmouth that went. And from that, that was a development of fiber optics. But in those days, we didn't even know what it was, Art.
So you just sent it over and said, figure it out?
Yes, we gave it to our labs. That was our labs.
And once again, they weren't doing this gratis or for an investigation. You were commissioning them. You had budget money.
Exactly.
Research and development money that came along with these items you were giving them.
We had a budget then. It was just tremendous. It was about $2
billion. $2
billion. Now, we also gave out RDT&D contracts, research, development, test, and evaluation contracts. The first item that would be built from a research contract, we funded the building to the first one. Then after that, other people, other agencies funded it. So we would fund these until it was actually developed. And we had our own laboratories, our atomic labs, and the night viewing labs were our labs at Fort Belvoir.
So
existence.
Colonel, what aspect of this were you overseeing? In other words, once you gave somebody a piece of this technology and a budget, what did you then do?
Well, I was supposed to keep track of it, of how it was coming along. For example, I went down to the night viewing device lab one day, and I had their budget in my pocket. And the general told me, go down, see how they're getting along. And I took one of the German scientists with me and two Army engineers. We looked it over, and the commander there told me he had misgivings when he heard I was coming. I told him, is my reputation that bad? And then I told him, but in this case, it's a little different. Look at my German friend. He's smiling. He usually doesn't smile. And not only that, but since you're doing such a good job, here's your budget. And I handed him the envelope I had in my pocket. And I told him, but there's a hitch to that. The war is heating up in Vietnam. We need this viewing device for the troops with 3 to 6 months. They did it. And John knows he had one of the weapons or one of the rangefinders.
Well, as a matter of fact, Dr. John Alexander has been, would it be fair to say, Doctor, a developer of non-lethal technologies for years?
That's correct.
Doctor, can you, in essence, back up any aspect of this regarding night vision? In other words, was this? Can you see a linear development anywhere with regard to night vision, or was it a sudden jump that would tend to back up what Colonel Corso is suggesting?
It's hard to say, and I've got to say, when Phil and I first talked about this and how they went about it, he described a classic black program, in which it folds back in on itself, is almost untraceable. Because remember what he said, and this is in Phil's words, they found people who were already working the field.
Sure.
So that it would not show up as, here's something, totally out of the blue.
So it could look as though it were some sort of natural progression.
Right.
Yeah,
ultimate problem with, if Phil is right, it means that we have to rewrite science. And you're going to,
we also have to rewrite history.
Well, I'm talking about the history of science. because it means that, you know, everything up to Nobel Prizes and people who have been awarded money and patents and all of that
should not have
got some help.
Now, we encouraged industry to take the patents, and I have supported this, and a pamphlet was written in 1963 by General Britton. We encouraged them to take the patents as long as they developed it.
Well, the alternative to that would be to tell everybody where it came from, so
right.
There was no choice.
Well, we couldn't do that because the climate opinion, they had destroyed our organization, Art.
I'm certain they would have. At some point, you must have sat down with General Trudeau, and obviously after you realized what you had on your hands in this cabinet, all of this technology, and you must have had a serious conversation with the general about where it came from, or did you never do that?
Oh, we did, almost every day.
Oh.
Now, let me tell you another thing, Art, you got to remember, too, how some of the developments came from the back door. In intelligence, you check also not actually what has happened, but you check omissions.
Right.
I walked in the general one day, and I told him, General, I got something here that's very serious. Now, I got to let you know, and we got to decide what to do. I told him, number one, there's no food aboard this flying saucer. No refrigeration facilities. There's no water. There's no toilet facilities. There's no recreation facilities.
Colonel, I've got to stop you and back up a little bit. You just said something quite remarkable. On this flying saucer, does that imply that you had a craft?
Not that we had in the Army, but I had the reports on the craft.
You had the reports?
Yes.
All right. Did these reports come to you along with the filing cabinet full of all
they
these?
They did. They were in the top drawer of the filing cabinet.
So you had a full report on the craft they had recovered?
Yes. Well, as full as it could be in those days from what they saw.
I understand. Here you had the autopsy reports on the beings, extraterrestrial biological entities, robots virtually.
The Sumerians called them Igigis. Igigis.
And then you had a report on the craft itself. Now, you said there were no facilities, and what you've told me of the extraterrestrial biological entities, it makes sense. They wouldn't need all that, would they?
No, they wouldn't. And also, when a general asked me, what do you think is, how do they survive? Well, I have Tesla's reports. And Tesla, you know, he was the genius in New York and then went out to New Mexico. He actually set up his generator right up there at Colorado Springs.
Yes, sir.
And Tesla, in one of his writings, he had that the body itself is an electrical entity. Our bodies, the cells are electrical, and you can propagate our system by electromagnetism. And Tesla actually said this, and I told the general, maybe this is a key, general, that they propagate themselves by electromagnetism, because we knew that their guidance system was electromagnetic because of the way it affected some of our missiles and other items.
Right.
So from those emissions, we started what we called irradiated foods.
I
told him this, we flew down the Quartermaster, or that was in Richmond, Virginia, and they fed us a steak that had been on the shelf for 2 years, no refrigeration. And irradiated food today, it kills salmonella in chicken, it kills trichina in pork. Yeah, we won't put it on the market because of do-gooders, and it's harmless. And the American Science Agency in New York has stated that it's harmless, yet the do-gooders won't put it out because it says radiation.
So that's another technology that came from them.
It came through the back door, let's say,
because
it wasn't there.
And I've got a fax here that says, "Hi, Art, this is really not complicated. Colonel Philip Corso is simply telling the truth. The problem is there are going to be a lot of people that simply can't handle the truth, and they're going to be using a variety of psychological mechanisms, including suppression, denial, rationalization, to avoid dealing with this simple truth." And the truth is that, Colonel, you had all of this material given to you by General Trudeau, which you then apparently funded, in other words, you actually began to go to American industry and give them this material along with budgets to develop this technology. And what you're telling us is that the technology we enjoy today, much of it, fiber optics, night vision goggles, and on and on and on, all came from an alien crash or alien crashes. Do you know totally how many there were, Colonel?
No, I really don't have the count. I had about a dozen important items. So I don't know, really, at the moment, I'd have to go through my notes that the book was taken from and see how many we did have.
Do you know, Colonel, whether you were the only one given these alien artifacts or whether others were doing parallel work?
I heard rumors that the Air Force was doing parallel work.
Uh-huh.
But we never cross-fertilized because we kept it to ourselves to protect our, let's say, our organization.
You also believe, do you not, that the Germans were doing some parallel...
They were doing it. Their scientists actually told me this, and people the caliber of von Braun and Obert.
All right. Yes. You've mentioned the names of several people, Colonel, who were involved over the years. Frank Kaufman, one of the still-living first-hand witnesses.
I met him at Roswell.
I had him as a guest on this program a couple of weeks ago and claimed to have been part of the cleanup team at Roswell. Can you confirm that Frank Kaufman was involved in the cleanup?
Yes, I met him out there. I think he was a sergeant then. And he was very happy that I finally came forward. We had dinner one night at the Roswell Inn there, in Roswell. So I was introduced to him. It's the first time I met the man. And it seemed he's my age, I think. And he was very logical and very emphatic of what he saw.
All right, well, one of the things he did, Colonel, was dispute your claim that a creature was shot at the crash site.
No, I'm not sure of that, whether it was shot or not. That I'm not certain of.
So that could be...
I think Kaufman is right on that.
All right.
I think I was sort of an error in there. I shouldn't have been in.
All right, since you've written your book... this is a very, very important book. If you believe it, it changes all of our history or a great portion of our history and what we think of ourselves. Has anybody senior in government come to you since the publication of this book and told you to shut your mouth?
No. No one.
Why do you think that? Why
now,
do you think that?
When Mitchell the astronaut confirmed it, he confirmed that I was a sort of a maverick. And... I don't take things of trying to stop me from talking lightly if anybody would try it. Nobody's ever tried it.
And again, the things that you're able to talk about, because they really weren't classified in the normal way.
Well, Art, you can see that. The chip, for example, or the integrated circuit.
Yes.
It's now known worldwide.
Yes.
There's no classification. The supertenacity fibers. They're known worldwide now. There's no classification anymore. Mm-hmm. Fiber optics has developed tremendously since our day. Our communication, there's no classification anymore. The imaging devices, we made the first heart pump.
The first heart pump?
We made that. The Army did.
And that came from this technology as well?
Yes. For the hydrodynamic. We had a car at Harry Diamond Laboratory, a little cart that ran on water. Same as integrated circuits. The electricity we put water through and it ran. And I told Senator Glenn about this, and he wanted a photograph that I had. I gave it to him, and I told him, call Harry Diamond Lab. They still might have it up there. It's the north of Philadelphia, north of Washington, D.C.
Do you retain a photograph of this?
Yeah, I have one.
You have one?
I gave it to Senator Glenn, the one I had, but I have another one.
And what did Senator Glenn do with it?
I don't know. I haven't talked to him since I gave it to him.
Well, Dr. Alexander, I can only imagine now with the book having been out for a while... With the claims the Colonel is making, after all, we're talking about some very serious technologies here, that there would be people coming forward and saying, this Colonel is out of his mind, we developed so-and-so in our lab, and we didn't get any special materials in order to do that, and I've heard none of that. Have you, John?
Oh, you hear some. Certainly. And you've got to remember, the way they did it, it makes it untraceable. By design. So I mean, if you remember, what Phil said was that they, if you believe the story, that they were handing it to people already working in the field, getting material that in some cases they thought was Soviet, but that the technology was beginning to move already.
Bell Laboratory confirmed that. They thought we got it from the Russians.
Well, at that time, and I'm just saying what I believe, our technological advances were far ahead of the Soviets, were they not?
Yes,
in most areas.
Some they weren't.
Yeah, that was not across the board. I mean, there were areas that the Soviets had done some work that exceeded our capabilities.
In fact, Art, we were really, one day, I went to the general, I was the first project officer on anti-missile missile. And I recommended the colonel, a friend of mine. He came to me one day and he said, "Phil, I got something very serious. The Soviets can take their ICBMs and change trajectory in the air." That was a very serious thing. That left us almost without any defenses.
In other words, it is not a ballistic missile in the sense that you fire it and it has a specific trajectory and it goes up and comes right back down.
No, it was an ICBM.
So they
intercontinental.
And they acquired this ability before we did?
Yes, the capability of changing trajectory in space. In fact, we went to General Trudeau and he got alarmed too, because that was a very serious thing. And we went to work on, and we developed a countermeasure within a short time. It had a crash program.
All right. You said the reason you came forward is that General Trudeau said that you could speak after his death. But wouldn't all work at the Foreign Technology Division be covered under the security requirements, other security requirements that you had to sign? In other words, how were you released, not just from his personal oath, but from those other requirements?
The requirements, mostly in security, were on weapons and things we developed. And some of the laser developments are still classified. I didn't talk about those.
So there are things still there.
I had all the clearances, and from this book, I did not violate any security because we didn't have the stamp on one of these things. The normal R&D contracts we put out, most of them didn't have the stamps on. Our Project Horizon was secret, and then it was declassified under the general's authority. And I did that, too.
And the general told you near his death that you could come forward after he died.
He said that.
Why do you think he didn't? Why do you think he wouldn't do it while he was still alive?
Well,
and back your story up.
Well, one day I was discussing with the general some of these items.
Yes.
And I told him this: "General, we have this integrated circuit. What are we unleashing on the world?
Right.
We don't know what this thing will do.
Right.
What if someday," and I pointed my head, "it integrates with the brain? Are we going to create some monsters?" And he said, "Phil, yes, what you're saying is true. But let's hope that the people come after us will recognize this and do something about it." And then he stated this. He said, "but maybe not in our lifetime." Well, it didn't happen in his lifetime. And even in 82, I happen to still be here.
Why, again, though, do you think the general didn't want any of this coming out when he was alive?
Because the climate of opinion and what was going on, even till he died 3 years ago and even today, that anybody deals with this is a kook. In fact, I told the Germans one day, I explained something to them.
So he was worried about ridicule?
Yes. And also, the skeptics and the department, the people at ARPA and other places didn't like us. And we knew who our opposition was, and CIA didn't like us.
Uh-huh.
And there had been a lot of opposition, a lot of smearing, and a lot of good people might have been hurt.
All right, back now to my guests, both in Las Vegas, Dr. John Alexander and Colonel Philip J. Corso. Now that you have come forward, Colonel, with this incredible information, surely there are others, other than General Trudeau, who has now passed on, who could confirm what you're saying.
Lately, I had four officers come up to me in uniform.
In uniform?
Officers.
And?
They confirmed, two colonels confirmed to me that this was true. They knew about it. And a lieutenant colonel came, and a test pilot from B-2 came up to me in uniform.
In uniform.
Yeah, I don't want to say where it was because I don't want anybody looking into it. And they verified this to me just 10 days ago.
They're not prepared to come forward, though.
No, and I did get a letter from, and I don't think he's, if I tell his name, he's McDonald's son, the scientist. And he confirmed to me in a letter he wrote to me before I left home, where he sent me a religious letter. He talked to people. He was on the Jason Committee. And he said that Hughes, North American,
mm-hmm.
and Wright Pat, people from America confirmed that finally they said we filled in some of the holes that we wondered about all our lives.
John,
he just came to me in a letter a few days ago.
John Alexander, right. Dr. Alexander, with what resources you've had, what aspects of this have you been able to confirm?
Well, what I can confirm is, revolves around Phil's background.
All right.
That, as we mentioned earlier, he had come forward twice. We actually only mentioned one of the incidents, one, you know, kind of the secret war that was going on. The other was a POW exploitation program that the KGB had run for 50 years, and that came out last year. And so he has twice told very unusual tales and turned out to be true. When I have talked to folks who, as I said, knew him, they state they cannot confirm the details of this, but state we should not disregard him.
Mm-hmm. Colonel, can you confirm that reverse engineering was going on at either Area 51 or Area S4, those areas out here in our Nevada desert that you are now very close to?
Now, from information I had, yes, it was going on. But I don't have the details and never bothered to try to get them because I figured that was a sister service. They're military. In fact, General Trudeau went up in front of Congress, and he was testifying, and he recommended and stunned everybody that instead of turn it over to NASA to turn everything in space over to the Air Force. And people were stunned when he said that. And he actually said this in front of the Senate committee. So we didn't bother with them. They were doing their own work. We trusted them and we let them alone. And we figured it's best that we stay where we are to ourselves.
All right, to this day, how compartmentalized do you believe it is? For example, do you think the President and our current National Security Council are now in the loop, or is all of this still off to the side and a government, in effect, within a government that that harbors this information?
Well, the government, you know, when you talk about the government, it's a huge organization.
Of course.
And I've said in some of my interviews, leave the government alone, it'll cover itself up. You know, and that's true. That's what happened. It happened on my POW reports, missing POWs I sent from Japan. Kissinger, even, and Skokov said that those reports didn't exist, yet they were there. We found them later. They just, people didn't want to do anything with them. When you touch UFOs, people run and hide for some reason.
I know.
And I guess it's still going on. Because I've been attacked, minor attacks, so nothing of any consequence. And Whitney Sabert, you know, the man who wrote Communion?
Yes.
He told me, he said, Phil, he said, some of the, at Roswell, he said, Phil, some of the attacks are, we're treading on their territory.
Oh, that's so, right. That's how you know you begin to get attacked. Do you believe, Colonel, that foreign technology, the Foreign Technology Division, may still be involved in seeding this technology into industry? Because we didn't figure it all out back then.
I can't say. I'm not clear anymore, and I haven't been in contact for a while. Although people tell me, like these people in uniform just told me a week ago, it's still going on. So I hope it is, because it's important enough to keep on going. And I think some of these developments, I surprised my son one day because we build airplanes, these Rutan type airplanes, and a B-2 came over an air show, and I told him what I'm doing, and he called me, he said, oh, no, it can't. Then he called me up and he said, it came over and it flew like a little airplane. It held near impossible for a big airplane like that. That means some of the developments are going into that craft. It has to be.
Say, Art?
Yes, John.
On FTD, and again, this was an Army
small Army organization, not the one at Wright-Patterson or the Air Force. And one of the things I was able to confirm is that when Phil came to the Pentagon, this unit was created, and right after he left, it disappears. If you follow what I did is go through the phone books for that period in the Pentagon.
So you were able to confirm that division at that time?
At that time, and then it disappears as he retires. And right after Trudeau left, because remember, he was working directly for Trudeau. And right after, a few months after General Trudeau retired, that's when Phil Corso retired.
Yeah, I retired 6 months after he did.
6 months.
Like General Beach, he gave me my last decoration, the Army Commendation Medal, for what I did with General Trudeau. General Trudeau. But I still stayed in touch with General Trudeau.
And 3 years ago he died, releasing you from your vows to him.
Yes.
And then what made you decide, Colonel, to write this book? I mean, you...
Well, one of the reasons I decided to write it, my grandchildren, the three little boys, asked me one day, what you do during the war, Granddad?
Hmm.
So I figured I'd better leave him a legacy and put it on paper, because really I never had any intention of writing a book, you know. That wasn't my area at all. And I started to write. And I put it all down, including my tie-in experiences and even other investigations that I did in the government. I started to put those on paper. I figured at least I'll leave them for the little boy, a legacy for the little boys. And some merit evolved into this book, which I never expected to see that.
Colonel, if you had not written this book, you're 82, you're not going to be around forever. None of us will. Would we eventually, in your view, know about all of this? Would there be anybody to come forward, or would eventually all those who can tell the story you're now telling?
Well, I think that most of them are gone, really, now. Remember, most of the people that were working with me were my age. They all had been honed in combat, and that's how we were able to keep the secret. There was a certain affinity between us. And I think that they're mostly all gone because a good percentage of them were older than I was. In fact, in the testimony, when I testified in front of Congress on missing prisoners of war, I told the, because the families were sitting there, I said that when I met the boys, Pamela and John coming across, they were younger than me, maybe, and I'm 82 and I'm still here, maybe some of them are still alive. Of course, it was a long shot, but at least it was some hope for the families.
Sure. At one time, Barry Goldwater asked General LeMay about seeing the secret room, some secret room at Wright-Patt Air Force Base.
Yeah.
LeMay told Goldwater, actually cussed at him and said, never ask me about it again.
Yeah, that's right.
Was Goldwater unknowingly referring to your room?
No, he was referring to Wright-Patterson.
Wright-Patterson, where those bodies went and where you presumed...
I knew Goldwater. I used to go up his office and talk to him.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I notified him when his private line had been tapped by CIA.
Did he ever ask you about this?
No, technology? He never did. He didn't know I was involved. And I never told him. The only one that knew, really, on Capitol Hill was Thurman knew. And Senator Bridges, Senator Eastland knew. But those were the only two. And McCormick knew. I forgot about McCormick. I was great friends with John McCormick, the Speaker of the House. He knew also.
He knew.
Because I went up to MIT with him and gave a lecture, and the speaker was a grand old man, and he was a good friend of mine. We got along real fine. So he knew. I told him about it.
One wonders, and it is reasonable to ask, Colonel, why you are the only one who has come forward this publicly with this information. It's incredible.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know any better. I don't know.
Colonel Corso, what you have said, what you're saying in your book and here on the air, is so incredible, so fantastic, that you would have to imagine that there would be elements within the government and out of it that are aware of your information, and there must be some kind of battle going on between the people who know about whether it should become public or not. I mean, this affects all of our recent history, Colonel. Is there a battle going on? Will there be others? Are you the last? What do you think?
No, I've had calls from some of them. They'll come forward in time, but I can't expose their names without their permission. Now, also another thing, Art, I really don't think that this is going to cause any panic or anything, because I think from what I saw at Roswell, when the families brought their children up to meet me, they're accepting this. They wanted to know. And they're accepting it, and they're going to go right along with it and live with it. I don't think there's going to be any great explosion or any panic. I think they're accepting it as a thing of the future, and I think it'll end up that way. And that's the way I hope it ends up. This is part of history. It's written now. The young ones accept it, and mostly I want the young ones to accept it because we won't be here that long, but they will still be around. And I think that's what's going to happen to the book. It's going to be accepted. It's what they wanted to hear.
Hey, Art?
Yes, Jim.
Can I interject kind of an administrative thing? I haven't had a chance to talk. I might mention, you know, Isaac said that Phil is high energy, and I think we can see that, but he's now in 17 hours today.
I understand.
So, but it might structure the kinds of questions you want to answer in this segment.
All right. There's news breaking tonight. This may seem funny, but it's not. They have constructed the world's tiniest guitar. It's about the size of a single blood cell, 20 times thinner than a human hair. It has 6 strings that can be plucked, but they are actually too small to be heard. Is this kind of... Actually, scientists at Cornell University carved the guitar out of crystalline silicon to demonstrate the possibilities of building devices at the microscopic level. Could this be technology derived from this same group of artifacts, Colonel?
It could be, because some of the things in there make a little sense. You know, that you just said. And the first transistor I saw was almost out with microscopic little wires in it. It came from the flying saucer.
What happened to all of those materials, the ones that were not turned over to industry? What happened to those materials?
I really don't know. I left my files there with all my papers when I retired, because after all, it belonged to the Army, and it wasn't mine.
You were a good soldier. You didn't take anything you're not supposed to take.
I was supposed to be the man who would stop people from taking things like that. I was one of those. And I couldn't betray the trust that the general had in me. You know. And also, I never had any intention of writing any books or doing anything like this. It never entered my head in those days.
Well, how did you come then to write the book? Well, I mean, did you struggle with it? Did you?
No, not so much. When I decided to do it after the general died, and the children, my grandchildren, asked me what I did during the war, I not only wrote this, but I wrote my experiences in Italy, you know, like I said, and I wrote about other investigations that I worked on, and I wrote all this as a legacy for the children, for my grandchildren.
Yes.
And then this book here, it started to develop from those writings. I figured I might as well discuss this, too. General Trudeau's been involved, you see. So I started to put it on paper. And when I got it all done, it was actually Simon Schuster already asked me if I'm interested in getting my notes that this book was taken from published. Because the notes is a different type of people, you know, that will be looking at that and not people that want to hear the story.
All right, Colonel, I asked you this on Dreamland, but I think it has to be asked again. On Dateline, I think it was Dateline, at the very end of the interview, you said something that people used to discredit your story. You said... you would tell them sometime about a time machine, or something about a time machine.
Yeah.
Can you clear that up?
Well, I discussed that with Hermann Oberth, the German. I think it's in the book. And that in time, I think, will be clarified, because there's other countries that are working on things of that type. But at the moment, I think I'll just leave it the way it is in the book, that those were discussions with Hermann Oberth at the time.
All right. If you had items from a crashed UFO in your office, did you at any time consider the possibility that there was potential danger, radiation, whatever else, on handling these materials?
Well, we considered that on the chip and the integrated circuit, like I told you, that we might be leasing something on the world which we didn't understand. You see, Art, I tell a lot of people, don't think that we were so intelligent that we knew what we were doing all the time. We didn't know what these things would do and how they would end up. Even fiber optics, we never knew how that would work. We didn't even know if it was wires at the time.
Yes, sir.
But gradually it evolved and developed.
All right. If our military, since 1947, has had the only physical evidence, or at least some physical evidence, of the existence of alien ET spacecraft, which would be considered certainly a reasonable threat to national security, why has the military shown no interest in civilian UFO reports?
Well, there's another thing, Howard. You'd have to split the military up. Which part of the military doesn't want to see it, and which part does want to see it?
That's a good point.
Because we were the opinion, we were military, we wanted it out, and we gave it out. Some of the Air Force people are the same way. Other factions in there don't want to put it out because they're afraid of being labeled kooks and so forth. But I think that gradually some of the new developments I've seen, I think, refer back. Now, that wing, that B-2 flies, there must be something on anti-gravity in there that I know about. But I'm not sure of that because I haven't seen it myself, see. And I never bothered. If it's classified, I'm not clear of any longer. I can't go and find out about it. But sometimes I hear from friends of mine, you know.
When you were given this file cabinet, how long did it take for you to realize what you had on your hands?
Oh, I'd say that I gave General Trudeau the entire plan within a couple of months that to start developing, how we should start developing. And then gradually, as I looked at the things and conferred with scientists and other people, I began to see which courses to take. And I'd recommend those to the general, and then a decision would be made. Of course, the general made all these final decisions. See, I didn't.
What is it like for you now, Colonel? Are you getting a lot of criticism?
No, very little criticism.
Very little.
In fact, already some of my debunkers and skeptics have come up to shake hands with me. So there is very little criticism. In fact, I'll tell you, Art, I had some misgivings on how I received out there. People meet me in restaurants at the airport.
Right.
Because I've never lived this type of life. I've always been sort of in the shadows, you know.
Sure.
And I had misgivings. In fact, I made a statement out there a few times, and Michael Letterman caught this when I told him. I told him, you know, when I see all this, I figure, what am I doing here? I should be holding my easy chair. Because really, never been in this arena before. But now I'm thrown in it, and I guess I've got to make the best of it.
To your knowledge, since those early crashes and retrievals and the technology and the bodies and all the rest of it, in the years between then and now, do you have any knowledge of additional crashes?
Yes, I had knowledge of that.
Oh?
The Germans confirmed it. Wilbur Smith, a great Canadian genius, confirmed it to me in person, right in the Pentagon. He came to visit us. I had a good session with him. Then the general came back from his meeting, and he told Wilbur Smith, he said, you and the colonel have a lot to talk about. I'm going to send him up to your laboratory. I was supposed to go up to Mayboro, his laboratory in Lake Ontario area. Of course, I put it off. Then when they did call to go up there, they told me Wilbur Smith in 1962, when I was going up, he had died of cancer. So that was a great loss. Then the general got a hold, when I told the general that, he said, sit right down at the table, and you write down everything that you discuss with Mr. Smith, because he's gone now.
Well, Colonel, you're getting up in age, 82. There are no doubt contemporaries of yours out there, probably around the same age. A lot of them may be listening to you right now. What do you want them to do?
Well, at the right time, let them come out, because this information should be told to the younger people. And I'd like to see them come out and do like I did. Tell the young people this. They're the ones who are going to be around. We won't be around here. But let them know what you know. And I think, and I know some of these men, if they're still alive, I think they will do it. They were tough men. They were good men.
Back down to my guests. Dr. Alexander, I have asked many questions, and if there are any critical questions that you would like to ask the colonel, you should.
Well, of course, I've had quite a bit of time to do that.
Yes, you have.
Before we checked him out, I guess a couple of things I would say. You know, one of the questions that comes up is this guy crazy? And we frankly, I don't know if he knows this, but had somebody qualified to do that, interact with him, and came back and said, you know, we may not agree with him, but he's not crazy.
Sometimes I question that myself, John. When I look back at these things, I have to question that.
Your information is so very serious that I would imagine a congressional committee or a Senate hearing would like to sit you down and make this public. If you were summoned to Washington to tell this story, to get it out in a public forum, would you go?
I've appeared in front of 6 congressional committees.
Public?
And I have nothing to hide if they're serious in what they want to do.
Public, Colonel? Public?
Yeah, they were public. No, one wasn't. The one that I that in 1962 was still classified top secret. That's the one I discussed with Attorney General Robert Kennedy. No, that's still secret, but the others are unclassified. You see, congressional committees a lot of times are not serious what they're doing. It's done for publicity. And I know I was on Capitol Hill. If it's publicity, I won't do it. If it's to inform the people, yes, I'll be glad to go in front of a congressional committee.
Dr. Alexander, do you think there's any likelihood that in light of this information becoming so public, such a hearing might be held?
I would not be terribly hopeful, frankly. And I've been checking some sources. I know a number of people on the Hill and staffers and people who work it. Face it, the political downside for a politician to get actively involved is much higher than the benefits to be gained as long as the media reports these things the way they do.
Well, that might be true, certainly, of UFO reports or people asking questions about lights over Phoenix or all the rest of it, but when you've got somebody the stature of Colonel Corso, with what he has said and where we confirm he has been, saying the things he's saying, it seems to me it demands an investigation, and that any senator or congressman could not be too heavily criticized for wanting to hear from Colonel Corso.
Well, here's the thing, Art, I can explain. My last testimony was in front of Congressman Dornan's committee on the missing prisoners of war.
Right.
They had a Czech general there. And the Czech general had been, his life had been threatened 3 times because he said his experiments come. And so Dornan asked me if I would appear and run interference for the general, appear before him and sit alongside of him, because I would add credibility to the general they were trying to smear, because he was Czechoslovakian.
Yes.
And the man told a true story. And I confirmed what he said. It was true, because I knew about those hospitals. I knew about those experiments. Now, it took a man like Dornan, who had the nerve to get up there and hold a committee. And the families were there that day, too. They were waiting for me outside in the hallway when I came.
Yeah, there's one thing Dornan has. It's that kind of tenacity.
Yeah. And so it needs that kind of tenacity, and somebody that will take it in spite of criticism. Because it's very simple. A newspaper reporter will say, well, this congressman is getting into a kooky subject. All right, some people maybe in his area where he gets votes will believe that. So why should they take the chance? I wish they would, but I doubt it. I know enough on it.
Remember, Art, there's a huge political downside. While Phil says he has not had a lot of overt criticism, that's because the book, I think, is fairly new and people are not directly threatened. If you elevate this to congressional hearings, you're now a direct threat.
that's what I was hoping for, John, some sort of direct threat to a lie by omission. I mean, it's about time. If what the colonel says is true, then he's our best connection to what really has occurred. And here's an interesting question for you, Colonel. If all of the technology that was gleaned from Roswell and any other crashes that have occurred, alien technology, had not been interwoven with American industry, where would we be today?
Well, I'll give you a little example. I had a file in one of my files. It was in the second drawer, which was called Project Rainbow.
Yes, sir.
This was von Neumann's. You remember John von Neumann?
Yes.
It was his project on artificial life. Now, I went through that file 2 or 3 times and I always put it away when I could have started an operation on that.
Artificial? When you say artificial life, what do you mean?
By computer. They're starting to work on that now.
You're talking about artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence, that's right.
You bet they're working on
it. Artificial intelligence, the wrong word I gave you. Now, von Neumann, I didn't start that project. And a lot of people told me, well, it wasn't time because there were no supercomputers then. Now they can work on that, and they're working on it, artificial intelligence, because a supercomputer is available now, which wasn't available back then. So I think this is some of the developments that are coming up out of this, that new things can be taken, can be new developments may be taken from that craft. Maybe they can work in now what I said, that the being itself was part of the propulsion system, part of the UFO himself.
Well, that also is interesting because, Dr. Alexander, I'm sure you can confirm, we are beginning to work very seriously now on integration of pilots with our aircraft. They tell us, or I'm told, that there may come a time soon when a pilot will simply think commands for the aircraft. Is that ongoing research?
Well, Firefox is certainly ongoing. I think, however, the next step is to take the pilot out of the aircraft.
And have it be completely robotic.
Correct. What they're calling unmanned aerial vehicles or unmanned, unoccupied combat vehicles.
Well, that's really what the superintelligence did. They took what they were or their people out and put a robot or a humanoid in there.
Sounds more like a humanoid. In other words, half machine, half biological entity.
One day I was walking down the hall with General Trudeau. And I told him, General, I think that son of mine is a little bit crazy. He says the engine stopped to him. The general stopped. He said, don't say that, Phil, because some people have certain relationships with engine and solid matter, which we don't understand yet. Now, this was actually General Trudeau's words to me when I approached him on that subject. So a racing driver, at times he says he feels like he's part of the racer, of the engine, of the car he's driving.
Right.
You see, these things we don't know too well yet. We haven't lived. And I think that in the book where I say that the UFO was an electromagnetic thing and the EB, or the extraterrestrial, was part of that aircraft, of that UFO.
An integral part of it.
He was a propulsion system, an integral part of it. This is what we're talking about now.
Do you think those bodies are still at Wright-Patterson?
No, because the lab said that they faded very fast. Their composition, I think, we didn't study it enough, really. We should have. And that was partially I blame myself for, because I could have carried that on, and I didn't do it.
In other words, the disposition of the bodies, that was in your hands, Colonel?
Well, I could have, at the time...
You could have followed up.
I could have followed it up and done something and made them study more with what they had before the things all deteriorated to the point where we couldn't work on them anymore, look at them.
The Air Force recently, of course, at the 50th anniversary of Roswell, or just prior to it, had a big news conference, and they disclaimed the whole thing once again. How did you react when you saw that, Colonel?
Well...
Sadness?
I can't conceive what they're thinking. I can't conceive why they're doing that. It's beyond me. And like I told Melissa Newsman, I wouldn't criticize the sister service. I follow them in Korea. I have a lot of friends in the Air Force, and I won't criticize them. And I told them, please, gentlemen, don't ask me to criticize. But they're superiors. I can't even conceive or why they did something like this. And I made the statement, if I'd have done something like that, I think General Trudeau would have thrown me out of the top window of the Pentagon.
We thought we were done, but Colonel Corso said, got to tell you about Albuquerque.
Art, this concerns you.
Me, okay.
I went in the bookstore, and there was 300 people there. And they set up a microphone. I had to talk to them. And at least a dozen women came up to me and said they'd heard your show. And they said, and Art, well, he sounded happy, real happy and pleased. I told him, well, I'm going to let him know that. And then an elder woman came up to me. She was not in the line. And she had heard your show. And she said she was in her sick bed. And got up out of her sick bed to come over and shake hands with me. And when she told me she got out of her sick bed, she was leaning over and I was sitting down. And I reached up and hugged her. And she kissed me in the cheek and started to cry. So I figured it was all worthwhile right there.
Colonel, I understand.
And she heard your show, too. And they praised you, Art, so I want you to know that.
Colonel, I'm...
at Albuquerque at the bookstore.
Well, thank you. Where do you go from here?
I'm going home tomorrow.
Going home.
Sit in my easy chair for a while.
Well, it's an incredible thing that you have done, sir, for us, for our country, for the history books. And I personally want to thank you.
Well, thanks, and I think you know, we're all part of it, so are you, Art. And I hope it works out, and I hope we keep making improvements and stay the great country. Some of the things we did there I haven't told you about that should be done that they stopped us from doing. And sometime we'll talk about those, too.
All right, Colonel.
Yes. Well, thank you, Art.
Thank you so much, and Dr. Alexander, thank you.
Okay, good night now. Well,
good night.
You,
good night, gentlemen. There you have it, and I'm going to leave it up to you, ladies and gentlemen, to digest what you have just heard. Colonel Corso is an 82-year-old man. We have confirmed, Dr. Alexander has confirmed, and believe me, he has the resources to do that, that the colonel was exactly where he said he was, in the position he said he was in. And you've heard his story. What do you think? It's very hard to turn to anything that would seem more urgent, more important, of greater gravity than what you just heard. And what you just heard, if you listened carefully, was an honorable, simple man who worked with, acquired and worked with, alien artifacts, saw himself alien bodies, and is saying exactly, in my opinion, what he believes to be true.